you'd go to think about going turkey hunting this year. I think we ought to go.
Mr. Willie, my mom wants to me to ask you, would you come down to our house? There's some kind of wild man down there in the woods by the creek.
Now, boy, I want you to go back down there and tell your mama there ain't a thing in the world to be afraid of. I'll come down there tomorrow and check it out. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thanks, sir.
You know, that's the third time that old lady sent that kid up here to tell me there's a big old hairy monster down there in my field. I guess I'll have to get down there tomorrow and see about it.
I was 7 years old when I first heard him scream. It scared me then, and it scares me now.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Karen Stolzno, Monster Talk looks at stories about strange creatures and legends with a skeptical eye. I was a kid in the 1970s, and it was an amazing time to be a fan of monsters. The Patterson-Gimlin film was showing up on TV shows, and several low-budget but culturally influential movies about Bigfoot were hitting the big screen. I'm thinking I should do some kind of coverage of some of the more influential films of that type. But the granddaddy of all the Bigfoot films wasn't even called a Bigfoot movie. It was a low-budget film based on the actual accounts of people in rural Arkansas who claimed to have seen a big, hairy, ape-like monster. Put together by director Charles B. Pierce, The Legend of Boggy Creek was in some ways the Blair Witch Project of its day. On a tiny budget, it went on to garner around $20 million. Pierce would also go on to direct the classic, quote, based on a true story, prototypical slasher film, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, in 1976. I don't know if it's possible to easily capture the power of The Legend of Boggy Creek in today's streaming digital world. When I saw it, living in the foothills of Appalachia, North Georgia, the summer night air full of the wail of cicadas and the cadence of crickets, the skyline a dark mix of kudzu and pine trees. The immediacy of the threat that some hairy monster might attack us through our screen windows could not be overstated in my young mind. We've put links to the Boggy Creek films and the fascinating book, The Beast of Boggy Creek, by tonight's guest, Lyle Blackburn, in the show notes at monstertalk.org.
Monster Talk.
Lyle Blackburn is a musician, actor, and cryptid researcher who explores the US in search of creatures in swamplands and backwoods. He's the author of The Beast of Boggy Creek, The True Story of the Falk Monster, and Lizard Man, The True Story of the Bishopville Monster. Lyle is a staff writer for the horror magazine Rue Morgue. He's featured on Coast to Coast AM and on numerous TV shows on Discovery, Animal Planet, CBS, and much more. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we'll get straight into the questions. And our first question is, how did you develop an interest in cryptozoology, Lyle?
Well, it's just kind of one of those things, I guess it was in my blood. From early childhood, I gravitated towards all things spooky and horror movies and things like that. And as I was exposed to things like the Patterson film and later on to The Legend of Boggy Creek, those things really actually scared me more than horror films. You know, I used to watch the old Universal horrors and Hammer horrors, and, you know, they were creepy and stuff, but, you know, they didn't make me, want to sleep with the lights on. But the thought of you know, something like Bigfoot walking through the woods, things like that really captured my imagination because I grew up hunting with my father. So I spent a lot of time in the outdoors and things like that. So just sort of that, you know, kid-like monster element of cryptozoology is what first got me interested in that. And, you know, I, as an adult and later on in life, you know, I mean, I read a lot of the books and then I just became a little more serious-minded about it, just trying to kind of come back full circle and say, you know, what is the real truth behind this? You know, I've read the books, I've seen the film, but, you know, what is the real details about this stuff? And that's kind of what brought me to it as an adult. So I still appreciate the, you know, the monstrous aspects, but I'm far more serious-minded as I look at that stuff today.
Well, okay.
I should go ahead and say that I really enjoyed the book, and I really liked the approach you used. You did a really great job of catching the chronology of the stories, but also getting the people's stories, like the people who were there. So this all centers around this town, Falk, Arkansas. What was Falk, Arkansas like? I mean, what kind of town was it before this monster story hit?
Well, it was in some ways not a typical town. It's a very small town. Back in late 60s, early 70s, the population was about 500, with other people living in the outlying rural communities there. But it was originally founded as a religious haven. So it was kind of a place outside of the Texarkana metropolitan area where they had bought some land from a guy, George Falk, and they set up a place where they could practice religion as they saw fit at the time. So it kind of had this heavy religious overtone to it. I mean, not real extreme in that mindset, but certainly different than just any old small town, I guess you'd say. And so other than there's like a church, you know, there's like a church for on every I'll say block, as it's
yeah,
it's like very rural. But
when I drove into town, let me just throw that, when I drove in, I was telling my wife, I was like, look how many churches there are. There's no houses, but there's like, we hit like five churches before we got to the main town, which means...
Sounds like Utah.
And there were all different kinds of churches. And then we saw signs for cowboy churches and other kinds of churches I didn't even know about.
Well, what is the faith there?
It was, well, I mean, when it was founded, it was Seventh-day Adventists.
They wanted
to rest on the seventh day, and folks around Texarkana were working. So, but now it's very, you know, widely distributed. But
yeah, there was a lot of different. I didn't see a Catholic one, but I saw a lot of Protestant variations.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah, and that's a perfect point. Like just you going there, you know, recently, it's still like that. You see so many churches. So that, you know, that was kind of the basis, which, you know, translates into that very hometown, very family-oriented type neighbors and community. And so it was that town, which is probably the most terrible thing that could happen to him, was to be associated with a monster. So
yeah,
it's kind of a juxtaposition. But it was, you know, it's a good setting because it is very rural. It was isolated. There's honest folks down there. I mean, these people aren't apt to make up stories. You know, they tell it like it happened, and, you know, some really good people down there.
Can you tell us a little bit about the early timeline of the creature's appearance? So when did the beast first appear?
Well, the way it kind of came to the attention of the public was through newspaper articles that started up in May of 1971. Basically, the first and one of the most sensational incidents was when a family moved into town. They weren't there not even a week, and they were experiencing something walking around on the porch, and they actually had a sighting of something large and hairy, and on one occasion it actually stuck its hand into the window. They didn't have air conditioning, and the thing, in my mind, was trying to grab their little dog or something like that. And So this all culminated into kind of a Saturday night confrontation. The men were at home, and this thing was creeping around on the porch, and they had, you know, done what any good-minded rural citizen would do. They'd borrowed a shotgun from the landlord, and they went out and commenced a shooting. And that resulted in, you know, it running off into the dark. And as the men went out there to investigate, one of them got kind of spooked and said, "Hey, man, I'm heading back up on the porch. You know, I don't see it here. I don't see blood. I mean, we probably just, you know, pissed it off." And as he went up towards the porch, this thing came around and whatever it was, tussled with him. He fought with it and managed to escape and almost jumped through the front door. And he was in such shock that they had to take him to the Texarkana Hospital. And when he arrived and they're trying to explain what happened, basically this guy was attacked by a huge hairy monster. You know, he had the scratches. The guy was in complete shock, and that's when the story kind of leaked to the public, because the doctor then called one of the news reporters and said, you know, "Hey, I got a guy down here says he was attacked by some kind of hairy monster in Falk. Sounds like a story you should, you know, investigate." And from there, you know, it was printed in the Texarkana Gazette the next day. The family was named Ford. And if you've seen the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek, that's kind of the climactic scene at the end of the movie that's dramatized there. Mm-hmm. And then basically from there was some other sightings. And as those were printed in the paper, a lot of the old timers said, "Hey, you know, this isn't the first thing. You know, this isn't the first time that people have reported something like this down here." Back in the 60s, not too long before that, a lot of the locals had sightings deeper into the woods in a little community called Jonesville, a little bit south of Falk. And so then this started to bring out even more of the story, and that was just articles after articles in the Texarkana Gazette. So that's kind of how it all became public, basically.
They go back to the 60s, basically.
During that time in the papers, one of the gentlemen down there, he had been campaigning as a county commissioner, and he recalled a story from 1946 in which a woman had told him that she saw something from her porch that she just wasn't sure what it was. She described it as sort of a upright hairy man type thing. You know, it was some kind of a dark creature, but it to her it appears to walk on two legs. And he cited that in the newspaper, and so you often hear that sightings date back to the 1940s. Right. Well, of course, you know, of course, in my research I found even further back, and I mark it at the earliest story I know of, it would be 1908. Would be the roughly when they first started seeing it in that specific area there.
After the Ford attack, I think it was Don Ford says he thinks the monster might have been a big cat. But that's not the story that really stuck. That wasn't the sticky version, right? That's what it was, the overall description that really became the iconic, that's the Boggy Creek Monster.
That it was large, it, you know, man-like, something of an ape that could walk upright. You know, in the Ford sighting, it was a little more of a shadowy creature. It was, you know, thought to be maybe 7 feet tall, and it was just hairy, you know, hairy monster. That's basically it. As some of the other sightings began to come out, people would, you know, further define that as it looked monkey-like. You know, the next sighting that happened a couple of weeks after that, a well-respected couple from Texarkana was driving up Highway 71, and they saw what they described as a monkey-like thing run across the road by Boggy Creek. And so, you know, as then it started taking on ape characteristics and so forth. But you're right, the Ford sighting, you know, the original description was very much of a Bigfoot-type creature. But, and it's hard to tell why they kind of, you know, backpedaled the story.
Yeah.
But it could have been because literally people were just lined up all down the street. They were bugging the Fords relentlessly. And so, you know, I'm not sure if they thought the better of it and tried to say, no, it was, you know, it could have been a panther.
Yeah.
Or they were just trying to get people out of there, like, you know, look, it was just a panther. You know.
Mm-hmm. What, in your research, did you happen to know, I mean, I know nowadays people tend to think about Buggy Creek and talk about it like it's Bigfoot, but I don't remember that being in the wording in any of the early accounts. Do you know when that first got associated together?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the you know, when people began to see it down there, say in the 40s or the 60s, Bigfoot was not, you know, a word that they knew. They would describe it as looking like a gorilla or a, you know, the hairy man or a monster or whatever. That was the only descriptions they had. Bigfoot, they, you know, in the legend of Boggy Creek, they used the word Sasquatch. And, you know, that may have been the first time, but all those early articles did not describe it as Bigfoot. You know, when it started coming out in the Texarkana Gazette and all that in the 1971, nobody was saying Bigfoot. They called it the Fauk Monster, and it was quite a few years later in the 70s, you know, probably before they ever even sort of, you know, called it a Bigfoot in any way.
I know that there have been a lot of sightings, a lot of anecdotal evidence for the creature, but has there been any physical evidence at all?
There's various footprint evidence, if you will. One of the main incidents that was also dramatized in the movie was some tracks found in June of 1971. So, you know, not very long after the Fords had their incident, there was a guy that was tending a bean field down there, and he came out there one morning and claimed that he saw a long line of tracks coming out of the woods and, you know, going back into the woods on the other side of this field. And the field was freshly plowed, so you could very easily see these tracks. And they were long and human-like, but they only had three toes. So that's kind of where the Fauk Monster gets its three-toed foot profile. And those tracks were investigated by a game warden and the sheriff and many people down there and many people that I've spoke to, and there was casts made. Then later on, a gentleman who lived in Fauk was very much a non-believer. This guy, you know, he thought it was just totally ridiculous, totally silly, and I've verified that with numerous people. Said, oh yeah, this guy, you know, he was not one that would turn around and make up a story. Well, he saw something walking across his field in 1974, and it left tracks as well. Now, on this occasion, he said it looked like it had three toes, but passed that on into more modern times. In 2004, a gentleman found what is more typical of a five-toed Bigfoot track down there, which I've seen the cast of that. And so, you know, kind of few and far between, but there is some footprints.
Fascinating. And, you know, there's a lot of people named Crabtree in the story. How big is their family in the Fauk area? Is it still pretty big?
I mean, you know, in relative numbers, I mean, the population there is only 800 today, and the Crabtrees date back to the early 1900s and coming into that area. So certainly you have just a number of families that their lineage dates back a long way, and they've since multiplied and proliferated. So the Crabtrees are just one of those that has a long line of relatives that live in the area. And, you know, several of them have had encounters. And a lot of people, you say, oh, it's all made up by the Crabtrees. Well, I mean, there's a lot of Crabtrees, and everybody is, you know, there's relations by marriage and other things. So it's not hard to be a Crabtree. So it's not completely, you know, not completely.
Well, that's I can't imagine them having a family meeting and say, let's make a monster. Everybody just do what I say. I mean, I know at my family reunion, we can barely agree on which fried chicken's the best. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah, so
it was nothing like the brainchild of the Crabtrees to do this, and or any of the other number of suspects like moonshiners or anything else. There could be no cohesive plan at all. And the Crabtrees just happened to be kind of in the center of it, just simply because Lynn Crabtree had a sighting. It was a young man, had a sighting in 1965, and that, you know, was a very dramatic sighting, and that got his father, Smokey Crabtree, involved. And Smokey was very instrumental in helping Charles Pierce make the legend of Boggy Creek. So, you know, just by those virtues, the Crabtrees just became wrapped up in this whole thing.
So when these first news stories started coming out, how did the townsfolk start responding to them?
I think it's like, you know, I've looked into a lot of these small town cases. It's the same kind of thing where you've got some people that, you know, believe it's possible and will be happy to talk to the news about it, or may share a story of their own, or that perhaps, you know, their father or grandfather told them. And then you've got probably the majority of people are just rolling their eyes and thinking, you know, this is crazy, this is nuts, there's no monster living down here, and, you know, I've been in these woods all my life, I've never seen anything, and that therefore there must be nothing. Mm-hmm. So you have an assortment of people, and you had some of the people in the town that did capitalize on the fame that was brought first from the newspaper reports coming out, because in 1971, just right off the bat, the Ford incident was drawing hundreds of people down there to look at the property. And this is something that you probably wouldn't have today. You know, it's kind of mind-boggling that just a little newspaper article like that could just draw so many people. Well, you got to times that by 10 when the movie came out and became hugely famous. There's all kinds of people coming down there, you know, try to hunt the thing or see it or just to see Falk. And, you know, some of the locals saw fit to, you know, at the cafe, they had a Boggy Creek burger and a three-toed sandwich and, you know, stuff. And they sold souvenirs at the gas station and made the best of it. And then, you know, got people that just wanted it to all go away, you know.
Well, let's talk about the movie then, because it seems like what you start out with, and I think you do a good job of explaining this in the book, you have sincere people with sincere encounters talking about something that they believe really happened. And then somebody decides to make a movie about it. So how does that come to be, and what's that like?
Well, it was just the right situation at the right time, I think. There was a gentleman living in Texarkana by the name of Charles B. Pierce, and he was quite a talented guy. He had come from Shreveport, Louisiana, and he had a background in graphic arts and television. He actually played a character on TV called Mayor Chuckles, and he was running an advertising agency at the time and was filming commercials and things like that. Well, when he started reading in the paper about the Falk monster, his first thought was, wow, this is amazing. I mean, this would make a great documentary. I could shoot this. You know, I've got cameras. It sounds like a good idea. So that was kind of his first plan. But as he got involved in that and going down and talking to the people that lived around Falk, it just ended up kind of metamorphosing into more of a horror movie. He thought, this is scary stuff. This is spooky. And I can kind of come at it like a documentary, but, you know, it's like, it's just sort of written for him. He's just got to film these people reenacting it. So he came down there and he enlisted guys like Smokey Crabtree to help him, you know, coax the people that had sightings to reenact the event on film. And Smokey took him out into those spooky bayous down there and got the great, you know, environmental shots of just the whole environment down there. And nobody, you know, thought this movie was going to be anything, so to speak. And then it was just so well done for the time period. It came out in 1972. Charles Pierce had a heck of a time trying to convince any distributors or anybody to pick it up, because, I mean, here he is, a first-time filmmaker from southern Arkansas making a film about a Bigfoot. Nobody in Hollywood cared. You know, it was like, oh, that sounds, just forget it. That's crazy. So he just started showing the movie himself in a theater in Texarkana. Well, it had so much publicity there there that, I mean, there was lines around the block. You'd have to wait two or three showings just to get in and see it. And it became this huge sensation. And the movie was quite well done. And for the time period, it scared everyone. I mean, I go around the country speaking on this, and I kid you not, it's like everybody's quoting out of the same little script. They come up to me and go, "Man, that movie scared the hell out of me when I was a kid." Everybody says that same line. I'm like, yeah, I mean, me too. But anyway, so it was kind of the Blair Witch Project of its time. It was made for very little money, and it went on to make at least $25 million. So it was huge. Once it got picked up by the distributors and all that, you know, in 1973, it was kind of re-released, and it played in drive-ins and theaters all through the 70s, and then started being played on TV. So it was something huge at the time, and obviously made this little nowhere town into something far bigger.
Well, I think people are still talking about it today. It seems like everyone I know has seen the movie or heard of it.
I know I have.
Yeah, we have, yeah.
Certainly. I mean, I was surprised. I mean, you know, I didn't know. I was sort of living in a vacuum. I mean, I knew a lot of my friends and a lot of Bigfoot researchers in my area down here that, you know, we all idolized that movie. It, you know, had a huge impact on our youth. And but I did not have any clue as to how big of an effect that movie made until I started, you know, till the book came out and the sales of the book and the people want me to speak about it and coming up to me and telling me their experience with it. I just was amazed at just how underrated that movie is, because, you know, for the effect it had on people.
Yeah. And especially, I know people my age, you know, I'm in my mid 40s. Holy cow. You know, it was a big deal, right? So, and I was too young to have seen it in the theaters. You know, I saw it, I think I saw it first on TV. I've never seen it on the big screen, I don't think, but it scared the pants off me when I was a kid. Now, rewatching it, I'm still fascinated by it, but the soundtrack is kind of like this weird mixture of appallingly bad taste, yet sticky. It's like the
so like orchestral stuff and Woody Guthrie.
It's got this amazing song in the middle. It's just yeah. But it's not the only movie that has a weird song in the middle that kind of just like destroys the mood. The Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid has that stupid "Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head" song. I hate that. Anyway, but it must have been something from the time. I don't know, but I haven't.
Yeah. I think so, to make it seem more dramatic.
I guess soundtrack sales probably haven't been a big part of the income for the film. So.
No, yeah, it was part of it was just, you know, of the times, and part of it was because Pierce, by the time he was making that soundtrack, he had no more money. He had, you know, it was just, they just had to get it done. I mean, he was making this. He borrowed $100,000 from a local businessman in Texarkana, was literally about to hang him if he didn't pay him back. I think he put about 60 grand of his other money into it somehow. So he's at 160 grand in debt already, which is huge considering the guy is just trying to make a little, you know, local movie.
Yeah.
And so I think they had to take some shortcuts. Pierce actually sings. He is the one singing on that song in the middle himself. I mean, he couldn't even hire somebody to do it. It's a talented guy, but, you know.
I don't want to knock the song. I just
It adds to it today, though, for the time.
It makes it it's a jarring disconnect from the tone of the film otherwise, I guess, is the thing for me. But it is a catchy little tune. And then throughout the soundtrack, like, you have these horn sections kind of replaying that tune. And so by the time the movie's over, it is stuck in your head.
Going through your head.
Yeah, it's you know, and I think it would hold up better today if the soundtrack was, you know, if the song wasn't in the middle and if the soundtrack was a little spookier all along. There's spooky parts, but it kind of goes into this, what I see as sort of a, like when I was a kid, they used to show these like nature films in school, and it was almost that kind of like,
yes, you know,
happy vibe for a second, like, amazing animals, and then, okay, wait a minute, you know, it's like,
That's true. You know what? I think this would be a good place for me to insert a little of the song here.
Hey, Travis Crabtree. Wait a minute for me. Let's go back in the bottom. Back where the fish are biting, where all the world's inviting, and nobody sees the flowers bloom but me.
Considering the movie, and based on your own research, how closely did the movie stick to the facts of the case?
Surprisingly close, you know. Okay. I mean, you know, when I set out to do this, it, you know, you see a lot of the early remarks on the internet and what some people believe the movie was, that it was, had been sort of structured around a couple of sightings and then the rest of it was made up. But that's totally not true. I can find newspaper clippings for nearly all of the things that are dramatized in there, the people's name, everything, or I can find people in the town that can tell me, yes, that guy said that, and that was, you know, him reenacting that. And, you know, while Charles Pierce certainly had an effective way of making it look scary and dramatizing and that sort of thing, and making it into a horror movie, he had to take a few licenses here and there. You know, like the Ford incident, it's real drawn out in the movie. You know, you had to add some stuff. It's a movie, but at the core of it, it really was based on real reports by real people.
You do a great job with it. You've got the appendix in the book. Again, we'll put a link to the book in the show notes, but I would commend it to anyone interested in this topic. You have an appendix in the book where you kind of tie the film sections down to what the real world things that they were representing, kind of the sourcing for them.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I thought that was important and something that I had in the process of writing the book, that I had to, you know, make note of myself just to understand, you know, what was reality, what was truth, and then what may have just been part of the movie. So, you know, I thought, yeah, it's an amazing thing. You can go through with the movie and it'll tell you the facts behind each little scene, you know, which to me as a fan of the movie, as a, you know, the little kid in me, it was like, to know that stuff is now like, wow, it's mind blowing, you know.
Sure. So the movie made a lot of money, and I guess everyone in the town got some of that money and was super happy about it.
So, quite the contrary. You know, Charles Pierce was the gambler on that one, and he made out quite well. Him along with the original investor. You know, he was, before he, when he wrote, when it was sold to the distributor in 1973, they wrote him a check for $1 million.
Wow.
Which is just insane. The town's, you know, Smokey Crabtree was often felt wronged by it because he was hugely instrumental in making that possible for Pierce to get those people to reenact and to tell the stories, and, you know, for taking him out in those bayous to get those shots. And, you know, while some of the townsfolk thought, hey, I'm in a movie, this is cool, this, you know, they didn't care, they just thought, oh, this is neat, there was some disrespect involved, I suppose, because the town was the source of all of that stuff and they never really reaped any benefits from it, you know, like the, you know, movie makers and distributors did. Now, of course, some of them did their best to capitalize on that, including Smokey Crabtree, who wrote some books and continued to make money off that the rest of his life. And no doubt that was due in part to that famous movie. But, yeah, the town just didn't make out so well with all that.
And what about the second Boggy Creek film? Was that based on further stories after the initial ones?
No, unfortunately, that's, you know, takes a dive there. The studios had been bugging Charles Pierce to make a sequel for many years, and he just didn't want to do it. He's like, I'm a filmmaker, and he made quite a few other really kind of amazing films. And he's like, look, that was my first film. I made that. I don't do sequels. I'm not going to, you know, do that sort of thing. But I guess sometime in the 80s, he decided, you know, he needed the money and relented to do it. So that one became much more of a fictional story. Now, there's one scene in there where I trace that back to a real report, and that's kind of at the beginning of the movie, which is the closest thing you'll see to Legend of Boggy Creek. But beyond that, the movie just becomes kind of just a rather silly, straight-to-VHS 80s horror movie, you know.
I believe I've seen the MST3K version of that. Is it, if memory serves?
Yes, it's now more widely associated with the parody version on Mystery Science Theater. So, you know, that's all funny. And but yeah, it kind of just downplays the amazingness of the original, you know.
So it just didn't make any money at all?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it made money, I'm sure. I mean, Pierce got a paycheck on that. I'm sure he had, you know, some kind of guarantee for him to even begin to touch that subject.
Yeah, right. I guess this was more of a not personally financed, so he was going to get paid. But the film itself probably didn't produce the way the first one did. It was probably what they were hoping for.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were just, you know, going, I mean, like they do with many of these sequels, they just, it had a huge name, and you knew a certain amount of people were going to want to see it just because Pierce had made the first one. And in between that, they had made one called Return to Boggy Creek. So that's actually number two. Boggy Creek 2 is actually 3, but they called that 2 because that was Pierce. It's very confusing and just, you know, of no consequence. Return to Boggy Creek was like a kid's movie set in Louisiana with fake Cajun accents. It did nothing for the franchise.
Yeah, we'll put links to all those great films in the show notes. But I think you did a really good job here of kind of showing the sort of disparity between the sort of cinema version of events. Because, I mean, on the one hand, you've got the film, which makes it a popular story. But on the other hand, you've got people who this is stuff that they experienced in real life, and they seem to feel ill-treated. I don't want to make a judgment about whether they were ill-treated, but what's the lasting legacy for Falk? I mean, what happens to Falk in the long run?
Well, you know, when I started doing my research heavily back in, you know, this has been 6 or 7 years ago, you know, I went to the town and I walked into really the only place that has anything recognizable about the monster. It's a place called the Monster Mart. It's a little convenience store. There was a mural of the monster on the wall. You go in there and it, you know, I'm expecting to see some cool stuff. I'm going to buy a bunch of t-shirts. This is the coolest thing ever. And, you know, there's a few like newspaper clippings pinned to a cork board by the door. When you open the door, they just flapped, you know, over there, like, oh my God, this is terrible. It's like a little display case, mostly with Smokies merchandise in there. And I'm thinking, you're famous for this huge movie, and that's all. And so, in other words, Falk never really, you know, it didn't become like this giant monster mecca where, you know, there's amusement parks, Falk Monster amusement parks, or Boggy Creek, you know, things like that. It was just very downplayed. There was a few things you could see, but for the most part, they just, you know, it was just part of the history, and they just kind of went on with things, you know. And I guess we can talk about how that's changed since, but that was really where it stood for the town after the big movie and everything else. In some regards, they just wanted to forget about it. They were tired of answering questions, and the newspapers had long since moved on. I mean, after the 70s, you know, it was just like, you know, it was just played out. So while there was sightings going on all along, they just weren't publicized like they were in the early 70s. So most people were of the mind, you know, the people that had seen the movie early on, they're like, oh yeah, it was a bunch of sightings down in Falk in the 60s and 70s, and yeah, it was awesome. nobody really knew that all along there had been sightings still going on, but that they just weren't highly publicized.
And have things changed then since you visited and since your book came out?
Yeah, there's been some amount of change that's happened. I mean, once the book came out, and mind you, I had to, you know, when I started doing this, the town was very skeptical of me coming up there saying I'm going to write a book about the whole history. And I'm going to approach this seriously. I'm not saying, you know, I'm not judging what anybody saw. I just want to know what you believe you saw. And I want to know something about this town that's connected to this. Everybody knows Falk, and they've seen it in the movie, but, you know, who are the people of Falk, you know, and what has happened with all this? And so, it's slowly but surely, as I kept going back up there, the people were opening up, and people realized that, okay, this guy's not going away, and he sounds, you know, somewhat intelligent and serious, and they began to share the stories. And so by the time the book came out, I did have some, you know, level of the respect, I suppose, and many of the people I'd worked with, a guy who runs a little museum there, the Miller County Historical Society Museum, you know, he read the book, and they were very happy with it, because I did talk about the town, who founded it, you know, we'll give, you know, set up the background for this crazy story. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, the book actually was beginning to draw more people and re-energize the interest in this thing. And especially because, like I mentioned before, a lot of the sightings that had happened were not very highly publicized. You know, some of them were on some of the Bigfoot research websites. Some of them had been told to, like, the sheriff or people that worked there. And I collected all those up and put them in the book and said, hey, you know, I'm not writing a history book here. I'm writing an ongoing story. And so that got them fired up down there. And the Monster Mart was under new ownership. And since then, the Monster Mart does actually look like you might think it would look. It's got a huge Bigfoot thing on the top of it. It's very well done. There's a lot more gifts and T-shirts. They've instituted a Boggy Creek Festival down there that that I, you know, helped them jumpstart to bring people to the area and, you know, just kind of celebrate the legend and bring some, you know, some people to the town and give them something to see while they're there. And so it's really been a resurgence in this. And that coupled with several television shows we did a Falk Monster episode on Monsters and Mysteries in America. They did a Return to Boggy Creek episode on Finding Bigfoot, which was huge because Finding Bigfoot has a huge following of younger generation of Bigfooters and many of those who probably had never heard of the legend of Boggy Creek. So when those guys go down there and say, this was a huge influence on us, look at this spooky movie and look at this spooky place, all of a sudden, you know, a whole nother generation is going, oh, wow, what is this, you know, and got into it. And so that's it's really a kind of a different thing that's going on. In fact, next week I'm going down there to film a documentary. There's actually being a documentary based or that covers the whole story, sort of like my book does. So there's just new things going on all the time now.
Well, that's neat. Who's doing the documentary? Or do you have any idea when it'll be out?
It's a film company out of Ohio called Small Town Monsters, and they kind of approach the thing like I do with these monster cases, you know, that to try to tell the story behind the town, the people, what was being seen, the legacy of it. And they've done two films so far on other monsters, Minerva, Ohio. They did one on Whitehall, the Beast of Whitehall up in New York. And the third one they wanted to do was, of course, Boggy Creek. And they sought my assistance in that, and I'm a co-producer just simply because it just, you know, I've already done all the research, I've already, you know, I can be, you know, I can assist them in that way. And of course I'm going to be on camera and I'm going to narrate the whole thing, so it's
great.
Well, that'd be cool. Keep us apprised of the progress, let us know when it's available.
Yeah. It's probably going to be, you know, early next year, I would say, before it comes out. But yeah, it's a really cool thing. And again, just sort of shows you this level of ongoing interest in that. And I think it's the logical step between, I've got my book, it tells the history, but you know, there's a certain amount of people that would like to see the visuals behind all that. And that's what we're going to bring in the Boggy Creek Monster film.
So, are there people still seeing things today? People still seeing monsters in the Falk area? Or what was the most recent sighting that you're aware of? I mean, I know you in the book you talk about some up in the 90s.
Yeah, my book goes through 2010. That was when I left off and turned in the manuscript, and that one had happened very, very close to when I turned it in. Since then, there have been several dramatic sightings. There was one the following year in 2011 that we did feature on Monsters and Mysteries in America, and that was a real story from a girl, and I investigated that case. The most recent one that I've investigated that I hold is highly credible was from November of 2014, and basically there was a woman who lived in that area a little bit further up the Sulphur River, but she was driving at 10 a.m. one morning and had to actually do a little U-turn on this little old country road, and when she turned around, there was something standing right there in the middle of the road. And she said at first she thought maybe it's a kid in a costume or whatever, but this thing just looked at her, and then it ran off back into the woods, and she felt like it was a real animal. And I investigated that, you know, as far as I could. I interviewed the woman. I went to the property where the thing was seen. I talked to the people that lived there and looked into the possibilities of hoax. And I'm quite sure the woman was telling the truth. She definitely saw something. And so, you know, that was a little over a year ago. So we're still having some, you know, in my opinion, unexplainable sightings.
So you've said that the book was mainly to record the history and the folklore of everything that's happened. But over the course of researching and writing the book, did your opinions change about any of the claims?
You know, as I researched the book, I certainly went from the standpoint of thinking mostly I'm going to write about sightings in the past to thinking, wow, there is sightings that just, you know, occurred in the 80s, the 90s, 2000s that kept going on and on, you know. That was amazing. And also just the level of credibility on some of the sightings, you know. I mean, certainly in all these cases, there's some that you have very little detail. It's a secondhand story. You know, you can't really, you know, you can just say this is what happened. But then there's some where I'm actually interviewing that very person that said this happened. So that was something that was great, to where I can offer my own insight into it instead of simply retelling old stuff or secondhand or anything like that. So that opened my mind definitely to just to this, I guess, a conclusion of, I just can't explain it. These people aren't lying. You know, they saw something. I can't say exactly what that was, but something happened to this person, and it's repeating itself with other people. And, you know, there was some people coming to tell me stories that I didn't find any credibility in their story, and I didn't include those. I only included what I thought were, you know, were good ones. So that kind of opened my mind to this thing of, it is an ongoing phenomenon.
Well, you know, we're a skeptical show, but the bottom line is that people see things. Mm-hmm. People experience things, and even as a skeptic, I don't know what I would do if I saw, you know, what these people have seen. And I suspect at this point in my life, I would probably doubt my own experience. I would be one of those, I can't believe what I saw kind of people.
But it's okay to say that you don't know as well.
But it's absolutely okay to say you don't know. But it's also okay to acknowledge these people had strange experiences. I mean, that's, you know, that's what they had. And I think
it's very valuable to record them.
Absolutely.
As well as
no, your book's tremendously valuable. I think it's really great for you to collect all this stuff together. So, it's not for me to say that there's no monster living in Falk. What it is for me to say is, I think it's great that you've collected these stories together. And you've also presented this really interesting cultural picture of how a small town is affected by these strange events and how it's affected by the incursion of this sort of the capitalistic money-making machine of Hollywood. Not really Hollywood, but you know what I mean? The sort of movie-making experience, how that has transformed the... how it's transformed the name of their city. Whether it's transformed their city is a different question, but it's had a big impact that's going to last for years and years. I don't know how long it'll last, but it's going to affect it for a long time. In fact, when I went to Falk in 2013, it was as you described it in the. It's now it's the big monster on the top at the Monster Mart, and I thought they had a nice little collection of Bigfoot stuff there, and.
I want to get there now. I haven't been there yet.
It was what I wanted to see. It was pretty much exactly what I wanted to see when I got there. So thanks for helping with change.
Well, I'm glad I could help make that into, you know, everybody's vision of Falk because, you know, it still blows my mind as the little kid who saw that movie. And I live 3 hours from Falk, and I had been in all kinds of little small towns. And when I saw that movie, it just flipped me right out. I thought, that's the scariest thing I've ever seen. And so for me, that little kid and that fascination is still in me to have participated in any form or fashion to, you know, further the story of this kind of blows my mind. It's very surreal to go to the town and people go, hey, Lyle, you know, the mayor's like waving at me or whatever. It just kind of blows my mind. But I did set, I think it's a result of me trying to set out. I am just simply trying to tell the story. I'm not selling people on anything that I can't back up. You know, I find it fascinating, the story unto itself, whether the creature's real or not real. It's still a great story, and that's kind of how I approach my books.
I didn't mention, we should talk about how great the artwork is in the book. Good job on that.
Oh, the illustrations, yeah, they're great.
Those are really, really dramatic illustrations. Where did you find the illustrator? Who is that?
The guy that did the interior illustrations is his name is Dan Brereton. He is a quite famous comic book artist, and he's done the covers for my band's albums. And I told him I'm writing this book, and here's the deal. And he thought it'd be fun and did them. So he's. And let me tell you, those things are, that's nothing for him. I mean, just these amazing paintings, you know. But he did a great job. And what I wanted to illustrate with those illustrations is kind of like a crime scene drawing. This is kind of the description of what the person said they saw to kind of bring it to life a little bit like the movie. But he didn't do the cover. That was done by Justin Osborne, who he had done another cover of a kind of a Bigfoot creature I saw on a CD, and I was blown away. I was like, dude, you got to do my cover. It kind of had that 70s vibe. I was like, that's what I need here. And so, my artists are just amazing.
Yeah, they're very different to all other depictions of similar creatures.
Yeah, in the original Boggy Creek movie itself also had some amazing artwork. That was actually a Ralph McQuarrie, the poster for that. That is that's a very, very iconic monster movie poster. I love that.
Right. Ralph McQuarrie, which most people don't know, he's the one that conceptualized all the Star Wars characters.
Exactly. So for the nerds who were already cheering, that's exactly right.
I think I was one of the last people to interview McQuarrie, because I asked him how the process for creating that poster went about, you know. Was his rendering of Chewbacca in any way, fashion, or form influenced by the Fountain Monster? Because I thought that would be the coolest.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Yeah.
That's in the book. I won't tell the answer. But,
exactly. Read the book.
Great stuff. And I actually hunted down the oil painting, the actual real painting. It took me years to find it, but I found it. Was able to get it and actually restore it to the Charles Pierce estate, in which they're trying to have it placed in a museum somewhere. So,
oh wow, that's awesome! Yeah,
It was hanging on my wall in my house there for a short period of time.
Are you serious? That's awesome.
I mean, it was like, again, like, how does this even happen? How do I have that actual oil painting?
Yeah, I don't believe I would have ever been able to give that away. I don't. It would have to just stay there. You know? Yeah. So that would be. Yeah, that would be really hard. So it was. So you've written for Rue Morgue. Was that also monster-related stuff?
Yes, I'm sort of the liaison between monster movies and cryptozoology, and that's what I specialize in the magazine, because I mean there's quite a few, especially now. It's just more and more of these horror films being made about, you know, Bigfoot and cryptozoology creatures, and I kind of understand the phenomenon from the cryptozoology side. I don't kind of, I do, and as well as a fan of horror movies, so it kind of is right up my alley to cover those things for the magazine.
Yeah, I'm trying to. So on the show, we've talked about how that there are obviously there's plenty of cases where monster stories from real life become movies. This is a great example. But there's also, we think as skeptics, a lot there's cases where movies have sort of inspired monsters, and I've started calling those scripteds instead of cryptids.
So, oh, that's awesome.
You can help spread that. Take it. Run with
scripteds.
It.
No, well, and I agree, and I've looked into a few of those things myself where I've tried to figure out which came first, you know. And
yeah, it's really tricky. Yeah,
it's something you got to look at in these cases. You have to look at outside influences. You got to look at it all just to try to discern the truth.
Yeah.
We'll have to have you on the show again about some other creatures then.
Certainly.
Yeah, we should come back and talk about your other book, which we can go ahead and put a link to the show notes for Lizard mm-hmm. Man, The True Story of the Bishop Phil Monster.
Yeah, I mean, that's another one that, you know, it has a lot of the same elements as the Fout Monster case. It just doesn't have a big movie associated with it.
Yes.
It's not on the same scale.
Yeah. Well, there is a movie. You're saying scale. I like it. That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, let me tell you, there is a movie about it, but it's not one that it's going to draw people to Bishopville. It's quite terrible. It's not going to even, you know, barely draw me to watch it. But, but yeah, it's another fascinating phenomenon, especially with a sort of a creature from the Black Lagoon type of a cryptid, you know.
Yeah.
Well, just in closing, there's a question that we always like to ask our guests, and that is, Lyle, what's your favorite monster?
Well, I suppose, is this a cryptozoology monster?
It's whatever monster you want.
Anything you see is a monster that is your favorite.
One of the things from where the wild things are. It could be whatever you want.
I mean, I would have to say the Fout Monster. I think it literally did capture me as a child and my imagination, and as an adult, in some ways, it's kind of affected my whole entire life. And so there's a certain love for that so-called monster, and, you know, that I have and will always have. You know, I'm the biggest geek about that film and about the history of it and everything else. So I think it would have to naturally be at the top of my list.
Great. Good answer. That had to be your answer.
Well, yeah. Like people go, what's your favorite horror film? Like, what am I going to say? It's The Legend of Boggy Creek. I've spent like years like hunting down paintings and writing books. You know, I'm just into that.
I have the same sort of fascination with John Carpenter's The Thing. It's just, yeah, I'm obsessed. It's ridiculous. So.
Well, that's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
It's awesome. I love it. My dad had shown me the original when I was a kid. I loved all the black and whites. And then that came out, it like kicked it up to just a whole nother level of – that was a pretty scary movie.
Yeah, actually. My son's 14 and he's been pestering me to watch it. And I was like, not yet. Soon. Yeah. Just not yet. Because that's some nightmare fuel. All right, Lyle. Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us talking about the Boggy Creek Monster.
Thank you. That was fascinating.
Yeah.
No problem. I enjoy talking
about
it.
Great story.
Thanks so much for having me.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. You just heard me, Blake Smith, and Dr. Karen Stolzno interviewing author Lyle Blackburn about his book, The Beast of Boggy Creek. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. If you'd like the opinions of Skeptic Magazine, why not creep off down to the swamp, wait till twilight, and then pop open the Skeptic app on your iPod or Android device so that you can read Junior Skeptic while you wait to see if any swamp boogers show up. The amazing meeting conferences are no more, but this October, the Center for Skeptical Inquiry, CSI, formerly PSYCOP, will be hosting what sounds like an epic skeptic conference in Las Vegas.
Barry, I hear CSI is having a fabulous Las Vegas trip coming up this October. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
PsyCon Las Vegas. It's our fourth PsyCon conference. It's at the Excalibur Hotel, which... Are you familiar with Vegas?
No, I'm not familiar. Well, that's for rich people. I'm poor, so.
But it's the big castle. We'll have a joust tournament.
Can I be a princess?
You could be a princess. There's kings and horses and jousting tournaments and magicians. It's going to be great fun. We have workshops. There's five workshops, including things like investigative techniques, skeptical activism, mind reading. We're going to teach you how to read people's minds.
Oh, Jesus. I don't know if I'm ready for this.
Well, there's some people's minds I don't want to read. But hey. So, yeah, we got all these events going on. I mean, there's a costume party. Skeptics love to dress up in costumes. I don't know why. We have two magic shows, Jamie Swiss and Banachek, who works with Chris Angel.
Oh, wow.
So Banachek's going to be there. He's a wonderful mentalist. There's just so much stuff going on. Workshops, we have a Houdini seance. We're going to bring Houdini back from the dead, finally. He's never come back before, but this year we have a feeling.
Barry, who's even going to be there? You haven't even gotten to the speakers.
The speakers.
Yeah.
This is the main part of the whole thing.
Right. Right.
It's the main part. Well, we have speakers like Michael Mann on climate change, Kevin Folta on GMOs, Elizabeth Loftus talking about her memory research.
Cool.
Jill Tarter talking about SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. There's Eugenie Scott. There's Lawrence Krauss. Richard Dawkins. And James Randi's going to be there. I mean, I've been talking 5 minutes. I haven't mentioned Randi yet. James Randi's going to be there.
Oh, that's awesome.
And one person I'm really looking forward to seeing is Olivia Newton-John.
She's not going to be at the conference, though, right?
No, but she's in Vegas that weekend.
Barry, I don't think she's going to come to the conference.
Well, she might not come to the conference, but she's just near there, so who knows?
You're not going to leave the conference to go find Olivia Newton-John, Barry.
Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you, if you had the opportunity to see Olivia Newton-John, wouldn't you take it?
No, I would go to the awesome conference you just told me about.
I'm going to do both. I'm going to be in two places
right
at once.
Right after you invent time travel.
I'm going to be in two places at once. Don't tell the skeptics I said that. Can we invite her to the karaoke anyway?
Barry, let's just say I don't think she's going to be hopelessly devoted to coming to karaoke.
But she is the one that I want.
All right. If you guys want to come on out to the conference, you can register at
csiconference.org.
You guys should register. We're all going to be there. It's going to be really fun. Don't miss out. There's a castle.
There's a castle.
That sounds fun. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
Falk.
Yeah. What the Falk?
Yeah.
That's actually, that's what I want to call this episode. It's What the Falk.
Got it. Great minds.
Inviting, and nobody sees the flowers bloom but me.
I'm low singing. Oh, go and get a glass of water.